make them say, ring the bell, sucker. Na 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 na. Na 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 na.
Na 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 na.
This is Movie Fighters, the show where Chris Sims and I, Matt Wilson, we watch movies and beat them up. Chris, we are continuing our series of movies starring rappers, and please remind the listeners of the title of this particular series.
You mean the title that I came up with for this set of Movie Fighters episodes?
That's right.
Rapper slash actor, right back at ya.
That is what this series is called. We've already done one movie in this series. We watched XXX State of the Union starring Ice Cube. And this time around, we're actually watching another movie that has Ice Cube in it in a very small role. But the lead actor is none other than Percy Miller. Known to the world as Master P, we're watching I Got the Hookup, which is about Master P and actor AJ Johnson getting a bunch of 1998-ass cell phones and trying to sell them.
This is going to be a good one. I am completely unfamiliar with this movie.
This is the movie that I wanted to do the rapper-slash-actor Right Back At Ya series for.
Really? This was the one? Because I came to the table wanting to do Romeo Must Die.
Well, we might not do Romeo Must Die, but we'll do one in the arena of Romeo Must Die for sure.
Okay.
But I really wanted to do a movie related to or involving Master P. There are a lot of movies with Lil Romeo, Master P's son.
Uh-huh.
There's one called Internet Dating that I've heard a lot of interesting stuff about that we may get to eventually. But I wanted to start with the first one of I Got the Hookup. Because not only is Master P a rapper, he also fits into the category of wrestlers in movies.
Yes, he does! Oh my god, you're right!
Because
this could be the special crossover episode between rapper slash actor and Wrestle Movie Mania.
That's right, because Master P and the No Limit Soldiers had a brief run in WCW, and where I think they took on the NWO, if I'm not mistaken.
They took on, Matt, how could you have forgotten this? They took on the West Texas Rednecks.
Oh, that's right. The group that hated rap, including Kurt Hennig.
Yes, including Mr. Perfect.
Not only is there that, this is also a movie with a wealth of raptors. Raptors?
Okay, I'm more and more interested the further this goes on.
To my knowledge, there are no raptors. I meant rappers. Because not only is Master P in this, there's also Ice Cube in a small role. Master P's brother, C. Murder, is in this. Snoop Dogg has a small role in the movie, uncredited as far as I know. And the unassailably, unquestionably best rapper in No Limit is in this movie, Mystical. Also, rap video staple John Witherspoon is in this movie.
So who is John Witherspoon?
John Witherspoon is in Friday. He's the older gentleman in Friday. He was the Wayans Brothers' dad on the Wayans Brothers TV show.
Right, he's Ice Cube's dad in Friday.
He's Ice Cube's dad in Friday. And he is in so many rap videos. Because anytime...
You may recognize him from the Boondocks.
Yeah, anytime a rap video needs an old man, he's it. Like, almost always. But... So there's a lot of like rap and rap video pedigree in this movie. And I also think this movie is interesting because it is almost 100% definitely Master P's attempt to have his own Friday. Because like, which makes me surprised that Ice Cube is in this. I've never actually seen anything specifically that talks about this movie being inspired by Friday. Or like drawing a direct line from Friday to this movie, but it seems like it has to be based on the timing of it and the like sort of the weird Shaggy Dog plot that we're going to see that it has and all that stuff. It has to be so in my mind.
And Friday was huge.
It's this interesting alignment of varying factors, okay? Because Friday came out in 1995. This movie came out in 1998 at the peak of masterpiece power. And now, nearly 20 years removed from that, I think we forget how popular and powerful Master P and No Limit were around 1998. Because not only did they invade WCW, No Limit for a short period was the rap label. Snoop Dogg, for a time, was on No Limit. Like, that's how ubiquitous and powerful of a rap label No Limit was in, like, 1988, 1999. Snoop Dogg jumped ship to No Limit. Chris, did you have a particular familiarity or interest in No Limit and Master P in this time period? Because I had a weird fascination with it.
I had none at all. And in fact, 98 was after I made the – or I guess 99 would have been when they showed up in WCW. That was about a year into me having completely jumped ship from Nitro to Raw. So I didn't even see them at the time appearing on WCW programming.
Okay.
I will, to pull back the curtain, I am re-upping with the WWE Network tonight. So maybe before the Royal Rumble, I will sit down and see if they've got any No Limit Nitros available.
I think they have just put up some 1999 episodes of Nitro, so they may be on there. I have not revisited, as is obvious, because I don't remember who they feuded with. I haven't revisited those Nitros since they aired in around 1999. But I had this very weird fascination with No Limit, and specifically with Master P. I remember I didn't actually own any Master P albums, but I remember borrowing a friend's Master P album or just listening to it and being so completely fascinated with Ghetto D, which was the big first Master P album. It wasn't his first album, but it was the kind of the album that broke through and really got attention. And then I believe it was MP The Last Don that had it had two discs, I remember that, which seems very ambitious to release a two disc album like with your second big album. And if I remember right, it is MP The Last Don that has the most baffling and amazing skit that I've ever heard on a rap album.
Okay, okay.
Because this skit was nothing but Master P asking, who turned the lights off? And I think it's Master P and somebody else. It may be Mystical or Silk the Shocker, I can't remember who, or C-Murder. And it's just, who turned the lights off? Who turned the lights off? They're saying who turned the lights off for probably a good 30 seconds. And then it just ends with somebody else going, I turned the lights off, and then gunshots.
We've talked about rap skits before. We've talked about skits on rap albums.
Yeah.
And how they are ruinous at best.
I feel like the thing about No Limit, and specifically Master P, is that the skits are as notable as the songs.
Mm-hmm.
Because aside from, like, the hits, aside from Make 'Em Say, and I Got the Hookup, the title track of, I think, the soundtrack album to this movie, and maybe a couple other notable songs, the songs are pretty forgettable. The skits, like, will get inside your head and not leave ever, even though they're the worst things you've ever heard. And part of my fascination with this movie, because I've seen parts of it, but I've never seen the whole thing the whole way through, and it's been a long time. Part of it is I just want to see if this movie falls in line with those skits. Because Master P is not only credited as producer of this movie, he's credited as one of the writers, along with Kerry Mungo and Leroy Douglas. And it was actually produced by No Limit Records. Like the production company is No Limit Records.
See, I feel like that, going into this, is a worst case scenario. If it's like a skit on a rap album that lasts 93 minutes, that is a living nightmare for me.
Well, we will find out if it is a fascinating experiment or a living nightmare in just a minute. But before we get to the movie, Chris, we've got to do the biggest blockbuster segment in podcasting. Snack situation. What are you snacking on for I Got the Hookup?
Matt, are you talking about the hottest podcasting segment of 2016 already?
That is what I'm talking about, yes.
No contenders for that crown?
None yet.
Well, listen. I know I usually go first and offer up my snack situation, but I'm going to go ahead and say my snack is going to blow your snack out of the water, so I think okay. You need to go first this time.
Okay, understood. So we're recording this on Sunday, as we often do for Movie Fighters, and if you were on the east coast of the United States, above a certain latitude, you are snowed in like I am. I've been snowed in since Friday, so I have not been able to go out and get a specific snack for this movie. So what I've done is just pulled in some of the snacks that I had in the house to assemble something for snack situation. I have two kinds of cookies. I have half a sleeve of Grandma's vanilla cookies, the sandwich cookies, which are delicious and some of my faves. I also had, because we were snowed in yesterday and had, you know, nothing really to do, my wife Marlene and I made some chocolate chip and butterscotch cookies that are very delicious, and I've got a couple of those next to me. But just so I'm not solely relying on cookies, I also have a roll here of Roundtree's fruit pastilles.
Oh, made by Richard Roundtree. Better than right. Shaft.
I wish it was. This is yet another entry into my long list of British candies that I enjoy. These are a fruit candy made entirely with fruit juice. There's a little sprinkling of sugar on the outside. Most of the flavors are flavors that you will identify. There's lemon, there's orange, there's a cherry flavor, a strawberry. But the purple ones, here's how you know it's a British candy. The purple ones are not grape. They're blackcurrant.
Of course. That is a dead giveaway.
Yeah. So I'm going to be snacking on all three of those throughout the film. Chris, what are you blowing me out of the water with?
Matt, I gotta say, you did bring your snack situation A game this week, and I appreciate that, and I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
Now, I will say, I'm looking out the window at a beautiful, sunshiny, 50-degree day outside. But, we didn't know what our situation was going to be, because it did rain, and it got cold, and it was just kind of, lousy out for a couple days. Like, we just got the rain and maybe a little bit of sleet over the weekend, but today is fine. Now, Aiden's in the kitchen right now making some cheese danishes, so that's probably going to be our later tonight snack. But my snack this week, Matt, and I should say, we did a little bit of a pre-rainstorm shopping, and I followed your recommendation, and I got a pack of Tunnock's caramel wafer biscuits.
Yeah.
Those are gone.
They will go fast.
Those were gone yesterday. Those were purchased on Thursday. They were gone yesterday. But what I have a Japan crate, Matt.
Ooh.
Now, this is not a paid advertisement, but honest to God, they should sponsor this show. Japan crate, I wrote an article about it back in December, but if you don't know what it is, it's a subscription service, but all they send you is Japanese snacks, which are amazing. Mostly because of the packaging, because everything has a weird little mascot. I am currently looking at a bag of chips, and there is a potato with a like a ruddy-cheeked potato wearing a straw boater pointing up in the air, and he has a sash like you would see on the mayor, but it says potato in English. I'm pretty excited about that. I have the January crate here. And so, Matt, I've got Asahi Kelpis gummies. I got milk chocolate Pocky. That's a high-end Pocky. I've got Hello Kitty strawberry pretzels. That's basically Pocky. But according to the description, each of these sticks was hand-dipped in delicious strawberry coating by Hello Kitty herself. So that's pretty amazing. I've got some juicy shortcakes. I've got some sparkling orange gummies. I've got some Fitz strawberry and cream gum and some yam white chocolates. But I've also got some Pokemon pineapple candy. So I've got some sweets, some savories from across the Pacific Ocean. Also, there was a pen in the box, and I don't know if that was included in the crate or just someone lost their pen in the box. So if you work at the Japan Crate shipping place, if you're putting together these boxes and you're missing a pen, let me know. I've got it.
Is it branded or is it just a pen?
It is. It's like it's a retractable pen. There is hiragana script on it, but there is nothing on in the little guidebook that says, oh, also we sent you a pen.
Okay. Can we go back to the Asahi candy for a second? Is that beer candy?
No. This is, I think that's just the brand name of the candy. This is Kelpis or Kelpico, which is a popular drink in Japan. And these are soft gummies coated in sugar and filled with Kelpis jelly filling.
Okay, so it has nothing to do with Asahi. Has nothing to do with Asahi the beer.
No, it does not.
I wanted to clear that up. All right.
Kelpis is apparently a milk-based beverage widely loved in Japan, according to the guidebook.
Okay.
That's another thing I like about this. They send you a little guidebook to tell you what the deal is with all these snacks you're eating.
Yeah, that's very handy. Well, it sounds like we are more than prepared with snacks for I Got the Hookup. We're going to take a little break here. You're going to hear an ad. Then there's going to be some music. Then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about I Got the Hookup, which you can watch along with us on Netflix if you so choose. It is on Netflix, so watch along with us if you like. If not, back in a sec. Okay, we are back from watching I Got the Hookup, and Chris, were you expecting a movie in as close in sense of humor, tone, and style to the Insane Clown Posse movies? Because throughout the entire film, this was the thought in my head, how much like Big Money Hustlers this was.
First of all, this was a fucking living nightmare, just like I was afraid of. My worst fears came true. And I don't know if I will ever forgive you for picking this movie.
That's fair. I understand.
You made me face the exact thing I said I was afraid of, Matt. You did that to me.
Yeah, this movie's about 15 minutes of plot and about 75 minutes of live-action filmed rap album skits.
To your question, this is not a movie that makes Big Money Hustlers look good, because there is no movie that makes Big Money Hustlers look good. Like, that is an impossibility. That is not a thing that exists. It does make Big Money Hustlers look better, because even though this movie is, I would say, competently filmed.
At times.
I mean, there are shots in the movie, right? Like, there are
locations, there's lighting. There is a cop car that doesn't look at all like a cop car and just has a red light inside of it. Like, not even a police light, just a red light.
Just a red spotlight.
But then there's another, like, cop car that looks like a real cop car later. As if maybe they completely ran out of budget by the time they were shooting the previous cop car scene? I don't know.
There's a Dragnet episode from the 60s where they're driving around and they're in, like, an unmarked car, and, like, they need to, like get through traffic or something because they're, like, speeding to the scene of a crime. And, like, Joe Friday, like, pulls out a red flashlight, like a pistol grip red flashlight, and starts, like, moving it around like a siren. like in like a figure eight pattern. But that's like 1967, and this is 1998. So this is 30 years later. I do not believe that technology is still employed.
Yeah. Okay, so the thing about Big Money Hustlers is that it only resembles a movie, right? There are scenes where Violent J just talks into the camera for several minutes, and that take place on the most bare bones, cheap ass sets you can imagine. And there's nothing like this in this movie, nothing like that. But there is a lot of just completely dropping any pretense of having a plot or following a story, and it's just people fucking around on screen for a while. Like, there's a scene where Master P and AJ, is it AJ Johnson? Yeah, AJ Johnson, who plays, their characters are named Black and Blue. There's a scene where they're literally just walking down a street, play fighting for a while.
For such a long time.
Blue is just wildly swinging at Black like a cartoon character. And it's not just a one-off gag. It goes on and on. And there are a ton of scenes like that where it's just like they're like several minutes of screen time for one gag that's not funny.
I feel like the genesis of a lot of rap album skits are the same things that are the source material of you and me doing bonus content for Patreon backers, right? Which is that we have a conversation and we make each other laugh and we're like, oh, this would be good bonus content. We should record this. And then we record it. But because it doesn't always have the spontaneity or the inside jokiness of you and me talking to each other, it is lost in the translation sometimes, right? Like, I think that's fair to say. This is the movie version of that.
Except half the skits are about a mentally handicapped guy who is also like a gang leader, but it's just supposed to be inherently funny because he's a mentally handicapped guy. And then
he's like doing the voice, which is like really upsetting.
It's the most upsetting thing in the movie. And in a movie full of upsetting things.
I don't know if, like, I don't know if I would say that, because there's a lot of upsetting things in this movie. But, like, in the interest of fairness, that is a thing that, like, at 16, like, as a shitty teenager, that I probably would have thought was pretty funny.
It's very 1998, yeah. If that makes sense.
Yeah. It's very, they thought Handyman from In Living Color was hilarious.
There's a lot of In Living Color style stuff in this. Yeah, but it's which, like,
by the way, In Living Color was on like 6 years before this.
Yeah, but it's very like ineptly done In Living Color stuff, because this is basically the movie version of the Homie Shopping Network.
Yeah, it's, I think that's fair.
It's if it's, you know, because the In Living Color, the Wayanses never wanted to make Homie Shopping Network as a movie. And I don't remember who was in the Homie Shopping Network skits. Was it Damon Wayans and Keenan Ivory?
I do not recall.
I want to say maybe Sean Wayans was in it. I don't remember who the two were. Because it's been a long, long time since I've seen any of In Living Color. But Black and Blue's operation, which is called the Black and Blue Shopping Center, they just have this big area enclosed in like chain link fence full of what is ostensibly stolen goods that they're selling to people of the neighborhood.
We'll get to that when we start talking about the plot of this movie. I have so many questions about that. But like, yeah. the thing is, the
technical understanding of cell phones in this movie is dubious at best.
The thing is, like, a lot of In Living Color doesn't hold up. Like a lot of like Wayans stuff, like I'm gonna get you sucker and don't be a menace, like that doesn't really hold up. Like it was good at the time, I think. Like I think In Living Color whole, like as a whole, was good at the time, but a lot of it doesn't hold up. And so imagine how little it holds up.
Okay, so the joke of men on film is that they're gay, right?
Right.
Obviously, that does not hold up. That's not a joke. There's a character in this movie who was, until the very end, when they do a Ace Ventura reveal on this transgender character, whose name is Tootsie. Tootsie is actually treated with a fair amount of respect, right? Like,
really? Do you really think so?
Well, nobody's like making fun of her to her face.
And I mean, that's true.
She's played by somebody who seems to be trans. I could be totally wrong about that. But like, she is not a joke simply for existing. Until Master P says so. You know what I mean? Like, she is treated as a character. Like, maybe you're supposed to be thinking, because there's a part where she's putting moves on this, like, kind of stuffy guy who works for a cell phone company. Like, maybe there's supposed to be a joke in that of, like, oh, he thinks that she's not trans. Like, in the back of my mind, and I knew it wasn't going to happen, but in the back of my mind, I was hoping that they were just going to, like, be together at the end of the movie, and it wouldn't be a thing, you know?
Yeah, Matt, this ain't Wild Zero, bro.
I know. She is not treated the same way as the mentally handicapped gang leader guy or the two little people that just by their appearance, that's supposed to be funny in a scene two cops get called to a domestic disturbance and they run into a house and it turns out to be one of the cops' house. And then it's just two little people having like weird S&M sex in the house. Like, the fact that they're little people is the entire joke of that scene.
Okay, to be fair, yes, Tootsie is treated as more of a character than those characters. Also, unless anybody's out there getting their hopes up, Tootsie is also a prostitute specializing in men who just got out of jail. And that is the joke of her first appearance.
Yeah, but like...
I mean, it's pretty rough, Matt.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. The people in Black and Blues, though, don't, like, tell her to leave. You know? They treat her like anybody else. That's the only... I'm trying to make lemonade out of lemons here.
Yeah, you got some rotten-ass lemons in this movie. Here's what I think defines this movie more than anything else. You and I were both watching with subtitles on. Me, because I've gotten in the habit of doing that, because Aiden likes having the subtitles on when we watch stuff.
I do it when we watch Movie Fighters stuff. I turn the subtitles on so I can get the dialogue right, because sometimes I mishear things.
Yeah. So there's a point in this movie. Okay, all through the movie, things that are just spoken quickly but are still identifiable as words are just written as unintelligible.
Yes. There's, like, stuff that we could clearly identify. Like, we could absolutely understand what was being said. Like,
yeah.
Get him out of here.
Get him out of here. There's a part where someone says, this is a deuce and a quarter, that's a YMCA van.
Yeah.
Like, not much faster than I just said.
There's a part where someone mentions Cool Mo D. They just say, Cool Mo D. That's listed as unintelligible.
Even if you're not familiar with the slang term deuce and a quarter, like, that is the kind of thing that, you know, if you're writing subtitles for a movie, you kind of want to walk it back and, like, because those are all words.
Yeah.
Those are all words. YMCA van, like, makes sense. That's just written as unintelligible. There's a lot of that in this movie. But then at one point, there's a good 2-minute stretch and there's dialogue. And it's actually that scene that you talked about where they're fighting on the street. They're doing their training montage, I guess.
Yeah.
And there is dialogue. There are things being said. And there's just no subtitles. There's just nothing.
Yeah.
So the subtitles gave up.
Whoever did the subtitles for Netflix, one, clearly is not a hip-hop fan. Because so much of what is said... that is clear to anyone who listens to hip hop is they just gave up and were like, I don't know what they're saying. I don't know what that means. And they were so not into this movie that they made no effort whatsoever to transcribe
and look,
what people were saying.
I don't blame them. I honestly don't. But I mean, like, I blame them for the kind of, like, crypto racist stuff.
Yeah.
Of not just trying to transcribe what is actually being said, but I do not blame them for just losing interest in the movie because, Matt, as you know, I left the room several times.
You did.
It was just like, hey, keep it rolling. I'm going to go get a cup of coffee. I taught myself to draw Mario. I have a notebook with grid pages, so I was able to, like, do a pixel drawing of Mario in my notebook. I freehand drew those shoes that Ramon was talking about on Ajax this week, the Adidas Stan Smiths.
Oh.
I got a pretty good drawing of those.
Oh, that's good.
In the notebook. I did not read comics, and I have a stack of comics sitting next to me that I was kind of side-eyeing the entire time. And the only reason I was able to pay as much attention to this movie as I did was that I made sure to, like, exhaust all my characters in Marvel Puzzle Quest before we started as a precaution
yeah.
to make sure I paid attention. Like, I wanted to give up on this, and we get money for doing this.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, you talked about this being the waking nightmare of listening to hip-hop album skits. As I've noted, I have a weird fascination with hip-hop album skits. So even though I did not enjoy watching this movie, I wouldn't say I watched it with rapt attention, but I was paying attention through the whole thing because I find it 100% fascinating. There were definitely parts where I started getting very uncomfortable. Anytime Tootsie showed up, I got uncomfortable because I was anticipating the joke that didn't happen until the very end. And for all intents and purposes, could have been a lot worse. I got really uncomfortable anytime that gang leader guy showed up. There was one point where, Chris, you pointed out, like, how surprisingly racist this movie was. Like,
yes.
There was a part where a woman who works at the shopping center was getting yelled at by a Latino gentleman, and she starts shooting a gun at his feet and telling him to dance, and there's, like, La Cucaracha or whatever playing on the soundtrack in the background.
And she is, like, yelling, like, Speedy Gonzalez, for instance, yeah, like, Andale.
Yeah, that part
those
is...
Those also do not get subtitled, by the way.
They do not. I think the subtitle is just yelling. Maybe yelling in Spanish. There's one mind-bending and super confusing gag that I still do not get. Where there are these two FBI agents, one of whom is played by Joe Estevez. You'll know him as the brother of Martin Sheen and the uncle of Emilio Estevez and Charlie Sheen.
You will know him as the Soul Taker of the movie Soul Taker.
That's right.
But not the werewolf of the movie Werewolf.
No, he's just in Werewolf. But he's in this movie as an FBI agent, and there's a gag, and it happens twice, where he and the other FBI agent, who are both white, they're wearing masks that come off, and they're revealed to be black. And I feel like the gag is supposed to be something about how if you're black and you're in the FBI, you have no authority. But it never comes through. And so instead, it's just this weird racial thing that makes no sense.
Yeah, I didn't get that. I read it as the thing where it's like, you know, like the line from Fuck the Police about, you know, if it's a black cop, he's gonna take you down even harder in front of the white cops, so they will accept him more. But man, I honestly do not know what they were going for.
Yeah, neither do I.
Like,
but there's another gag that's sort of like is intentionally jabbing at racism when these two white cops arrest this character. I think he's supposed to be Blue's cousin who is selling cell phones for them. And the white cop says to the cousin, I bet you wish there were a million of you now. As like in reference to the Million Man March?
Yes.
Which is like almost like on the precipice of being a good joke. Because like, oh, that white cop is so racist, right? But like, it's just not quite there. But I feel like that is sort of what they're trying to get across with the other thing, but it never works.
I do feel like that is something that a racist cop would say.
Yes, absolutely.
There is an authenticity to that.
Yes. Okay, so let's burn through the plot of this movie super fast, because there's not that much to get through.
There's not that much to get through, but I will say, we stopped watching this movie, what, 15 minutes ago? And I legit have no idea how any of the plots resolve.
It's nonsense. The end of this movie is nonsense, but let me go through the plot. So, okay. Black and Blue are at their shopping center. They're selling stuff. These two women are show up with a TV that's not working. They're trying to get the TV fixed or get a replacement. Black, played by Master P, he comes out and he's like, no, we're not going to replace your TV, but take it to our repair shop and they'll help you out there. The two women take it to the repair shop and John Witherspoon is there. John Witherspoon is only introduced so that Black and Blue can hide out at his place a little later and we can get
Matt,
some nudity in the movie.
Can I stop you for a second?
Sure.
You said shopping center.
Yeah.
And for people who haven't seen this movie, they are imagining something that is not what is in this movie.
Well, we kind of described it, right? It's the movie version of the Homeboy Shopping Network.
Yeah, but it's like fucking Barter Town, dude.
It's true. Like,
it's like Mad Max times. They have like hollowed out cars that they are like doing business in.
They're doing credit checks. In the hollowed out
cars. They're doing
cars.
Credit checks, like, in a junked car that has been, like, gutted and remade into... Like, I swear to God, it's like fucking Fury Road.
Yeah, it does
they
have that...
They are in Mad Max times.
It definitely has that aesthetic. So...
It's super weird. It's kind of my favorite thing about the movie, to be honest.
My question is, how is this business allowed to exist? Because, like, it's out in the open. Like, nobody... is trying to hide that this place is there. Master P continually calls it his business. I know it's not licensed. Like, how is nobody, like, showing up and hassling them, trying to shut them down all the time?
I mean, I can buy that just by virtue of there not being a lot of police presence in this neighborhood.
Maybe.
But at one point... The guy from the cell phone company is looking for Black and Blue, and they have, like, this place is this like a parking lot. It's like a
parking lot
that has been converted into Barter Town, okay?
Yeah.
Like, I would not be surprised if there was just a Thunderdome right off screen.
Yeah,
but
it's a huge place.
And there's, like, signs. There are signs up that say, like, Black and Blue's Emporium. Like, it's like a Fallout village.
Yeah, exactly.
It is exactly like a settlement in Fallout 4. And yet, like, when the guy's walking around, he's, like, stopping people and asking, he's like, do you know where I could find Black and Blue? Like, and he has to ask several people. And it's like, he never just happens to walk by this massive street market.
But what does happen to go by the massive street market... is a delivery truck driven by an older white man. He's got this cargo, but he doesn't know where he's going. So he pulls over and he asks Blue, who's standing on the side of the road, hey, can you tell me where 9,000, whatever the street they're on, is? I've got to deliver this stuff in the back to Mr. Goldstein. I got to get to Mr. Goldstein's place. Which means they're just like... a few blocks away from whatever company these cell phones were going to get delivered to. Which is another reason, like, the whole thing about the police presence kind of doesn't hold up, but whatever. Blue is like, man, I don't know where that is. I don't know who Mr. Goldstein is. But then Master P, recognizing a business opportunity, walks over to the van and he goes, oh, never mind. I'm Mr. Goldstein. And he turns behind him and makes the 6,000 on the wall into a 9,000. And he goes, yeah, I'm Mr. Goldstein. That stuff's for me. So he pays the guy in the van all the cash they've made from that day, and the guy in the van gets out several boxes and puts it on the sidewalk and says, like, oh, great doing business with you, Mr. Goldstein. Thank you so much. And he drives away. Although he comes back a couple more times throughout the movie and gives them more cell phones. But then Black and Blue open up the boxes in front of them, and they're just full of, like, bubble wrap. They finally get down to the bubble wrap, and what is inside the boxes is 1998-ass flip phones in Ziploc bags. Not even in boxes. They are just packaged in straight-up Ziploc bags.
Now, here is my question about this. Presumably, like, we see Black and Blue selling everything. Right? Like, they sell TVs. They sell milk at one point, and someone tries to return the milk.
Yeah.
And like, there's a jar of pig's feet at one point, and, mm-hmm. like, it is this weird thing where they sell everything, and it's super weird. So I fully buy Black being like, yeah, like, whatever this is, I can sell it. Like, yes, I'm Mr. Goldstein. And whatever this delivery is, I can sell it. Because he doesn't know what it is. Like, it could be a FedEx envelope, you know? But even though he doesn't have to, he gives the driver all the money they've made that day, which is a large wad of money. Blind.
Yes.
Not knowing what's in the truck.
It could be
anything.
It could be bearer bonds.
It could literally be a letter. It could be yeah. a certified letter. Fortunately, it's a truckload of cell phones in Ziploc bags.
Yeah, that are clearly stolen because they're not in packaging. They're in Ziploc bags. So,
and he's like, and before they open it up, like, am I misremembering that? Because I might be. Before they open it up, Blue is like, "What are you doing, giving away all our profits?" Which is exactly what I thought.
Yeah,
and Black says, "Don't worry, man. I got the hookup," which is the title of the movie, which is spoken three times.
Yeah, not the only time he says it.
But he, like, how does he know he has the hookup? Because it turns out Black does, in fact, have the hookup that would be necessary to sell cell phones to people.
Okay.
And provide cell phone service.
Here's the thing where it starts getting really confusing, though. Okay? So he gets out these cell phones, and he goes, oh, okay. Yeah, we can sell these cell phones to people. We can make a lot of money. We'll be all set. I just have to go talk to my little bro to get chips for the phones. And I have to go talk to my girl who works for the cell phone company so we can get everybody service. Now, I don't know how she provides them service. I don't know how the little bro has the chips or how he knows what chips will go in these phones. There's a scene later where there's a guy in a van, in like the front seat of a van, trying to just like force chips that don't really go in these phones into these particular models. And I guess what they're talking about is SIM cards. But they're continually referred to as chips.
Matt, you were thinking about this way too hard. Like, all you need to know is that whatever he's doing to the phones to make them work is illegal and also allows cell phone conversations to be broadcast over the radio.
Yeah, yeah. We'll get to that in a second. So Black goes and visits Lil Bro, who is the only name that he's referred to as in the movie, at a funeral. He decides that the best place to visit him is at a funeral, and it's because they want to have a silly scene break out where two older women have a fight at the funeral. Because one lady spits on a corpse, on the body, because this guy stole something from her one time. So that's a great gag. But anyway, little bro gets him the chips. Then there's a scene where Black goes and visits his girlfriend at a Japanese restaurant, which Black refers to as a Chinese restaurant. And then this is the moment where he said that the movie was shockingly racist, because Master P does a really offensive stereotype voice where he asks for a hamburger at what he calls a Chinese restaurant.
He also says at this part, I believe the phrase is, I have never eaten at a Chinese restaurant before.
Yeah.
Which seems unlikely.
Seems unlikely. Also says he is not going to take his shoes off. And this Japanese restaurant is like a pagoda. Like there's no chairs.
It's like a monastery.
Yeah. And his lady friend who I'm going to have to look up her name because I don't remember.
Her name is Lorraine.
Okay. She's wearing like a kimono and everything. Like I want to know how she and Black got together.
Lorraine works at a cell phone company. In whatever position she's in, she is not in charge, but she is high level enough to allow Black and Blue to pirate cell phone signals and cell phone frequencies, which I don't know if that's a thing, but I assume it is because I don't know how cell phones work, so I cannot argue with the logic of this movie in the slightest. But whatever she does, she is a mid-level employee. She does not have an office. She has a cubicle.
Yeah, she works in the fraud department. I know that much.
Right. But also, she is rich enough that later in the movie, her house is going to be referred to as the Batcave, or as I wrote down, the remote control fuck grotto.
Yes.
Not without reason.
Yes.
So, yes, I would also love to know how she met Black.
Well, because also, like, she seems to be, like, pretty cultured, right? Like, she wears a kimono to the Japanese restaurant and wants to go to the Japanese restaurant and really appreciates her high-paying job at the cell phone company, while Black is constantly shitting on her cell phone company job, only wants to use it for his criminal enterprise, and calls the Japanese restaurant that she was really excited to go to a Chinese restaurant that he doesn't want to go to and orders a hamburger. So, like, why are they together?
Yeah, Black is a very bad boyfriend.
Yes. Anyway, she gets cell phone service somehow. So now they have the chips and the service. So they're selling cell phones to everybody in the neighborhood. They've got a huge operation going of selling cell phones. Immediately at the offices of the cell phone company, Lorraine's boss, who again is this very like high-strung guy, tells her and everybody else in the office, somebody's pirating cell phone signals. We're getting all this unsubstantiated traffic on the south side. I'm going to get to the bottom of it. So he shows up in Black and Blue's neighborhood, and as we talked about earlier, starts asking around about where Black and Blue are, and somehow never manages to find them.
I think it's safe to say that this movie takes place in Los Angeles, by the way, but that is never mentioned.
Yeah, and it's not where
the only location that is mentioned is the south side. It's very noir. It's yeah, very film noir.
That makes me think Chicago, right? But Master P's from New Orleans, so I don't know where it's supposed to be.
He's from New Orleans, but he lived in L.A.
Then it's probably L.A. Yeah. That makes the most sense.
Like all the great noirs.
That's right. L.A. or San Francisco.
Big sleeve, the long goodbye, I got the hookup, the noir canon.
That's right. Meanwhile, here comes Tiny Lister, who we did not mention in the opening part of this, but Tiny Lister is a gang enforcer. He's like the number two to this gang leader named Roscoe. He shows up for one of Black and Blue's salesmen, the cousin, and he demands that this guy sell him 10 phones and to give him only the nice ones, not to any of this crap they're selling everybody else. So everybody is terrified of Tile, so they sell him all the cell phones he wants right away because he's a very intimidating guy. Cut to a scene at like sort of like a party in a park where there's this radio station set up. They're playing a Little Kim song, and people in the park are just kind of partying. Tile is there. And he gets a phone call from Roscoe. There's a hilarious part where Roscoe answers the or Tile answers the phone and calls Roscoe, who has called him a bitch, because I guess that's how he answers the phone. And Roscoe yells at him for a while because he's somebody that definitely shouldn't be called that. And then Roscoe starts talking to Teele over the phone quite openly about how he wants Teele to go find a locker at some undisclosed location, which has $70,000 in it, and bring him back his $70,000. Unfortunately, because the cell phones are a little screwy and aren't quite working right, this phone call is broadcast over the radio. Everybody listening to the radio can hear this. So this starts up it's a mad world situation where everybody in the city, is opening up various lockers trying to find this $70,000. Turns out it's in a locker at like the power plant or the WWE Performance Center, because it's full of these guys in like wrestling tights. And there's this dude in the locker room who busts up on the locker and finds the $70,000. Teele is watching this happen as people run off with the $70,000 and ends up calling Roscoe back. And instead of getting punished himself, which it seems like Teele should be the one who's getting punished for this, right? Roscoe says, "We got to take down Black and Blue right now."
I also want to point out that Teele does not move to stop this at all.
He tries to go and get the money, but that's about it.
When the guy finds the money in the locker and then the developmental talent jump him, like, Teele is there watching it all, and he does not go in that room and try to claim the money himself, which is weird because Teele, again, is Tiny Lister, who is a very large and intimidating man, but also in this movie is very easy to beat in a fight.
Yeah, but there's like 20 people. Like, I don't think he could take all 20 people. And the money
was
has
Zeus
like...
Was Zeus ever in the Royal Rumble?
I don't...
Because we would be able to verify this if he was.
I don't remember. I think he had a match at SummerSlam. I don't think he was in the Royal Rumble. But, like, they're already, like, running away with the money by the time he's seeing this. So I guess it's conceivable that he couldn't have gotten the money back. Either way. So... we've got the cell phone company after Black and Blue. We've got Roscoe and Teele coming after Black and Blue. We also have the FBI coming after Black and Blue, because the head of the fraud department at the cell phone company has gone directly to the Justice Department to tell them about all this illegal cell phone activity that's going on the South Side. So now we have Joe Estevez and the other FBI agent guy doing surveillance on Black and Blue, trying to get them. They also arrest Little Bro in their attempt to get at Black and Blue. So that's where we are. Black and Blue have been on an adventure of follies, just doing a bunch of dumb skits through this whole thing. They eventually end up at the repair shop that they were talking about earlier, where John Witherspoon is. They end up laying low there, but Lorraine shows up there and tells them that they have to go because Roscoe is trying to kill them. So they go and they meet up with Ice Cube. And when Ice Cube finally shows up in this movie, it's like a beaming ray of light. It's like...
it is a breath of fresh air.
Oh, my God. We've been waiting for you to show up, Ice Cube. And unfortunately, he's only on screen for maybe like 3 minutes.
Not long.
Yeah. But he ends up selling Black and Blue some guns. And I don't know if he actually sells them a bomb or not, but Master P claims to have a bomb. There's also somewhere in here where Teele finds Black and Blue and tries to have them killed, but fucking Master P beats up Tiny Lister.
Zeus,
which made me madder than anything. I get all the terrible offensive humor in this movie because of when it came out and because of the humor I am familiar with from rap album skits, but making me believe that Master P can beat up Zeus, a bridge too far.
Also seems like a direct challenge to Friday.
Yeah.
It does seem like, even though Debo does get knocked out in Friday, famously, like Teele is not at all intimidating after this point.
Yeah. And it makes it super weird that Ice Cube's in this movie. It's super weird that Ice Cube's in this movie because this is such a like obvious Friday, like trying to build on the success of Friday or take away some success from Friday, honestly.
Yeah, but I mean, Friday was much, much earlier than this. Like
3 years, not that much earlier.
Was it only 3 years?
Yeah.
I mean, this movie does seem like the Asylum Films version of Friday.
It kind of does, yes. After Master P buys this equipment from Ice Cube, he goes into this bar that is apparently Roscoe's stronghold. It's a strip club. Because there's this camera on the wall that keeps moving around, and Roscoe's voice is coming out of it. And Master P is talking to him on this, like, secret phone that doesn't have any numbers on the keypad. It's just a direct line to Roscoe. And Master P's like, I don't have your $70,000, but I gotta talk to you about this stuff because I'm trying to run a business and I have a bomb in my backpack. If you don't let me go and let me do my thing and get T-Lay off of me, T-Lay and his gang off of me, I'm gonna blow up this place. And Roscoe sort of tentatively agrees to this, but as soon as Black and Blue leave, he tells T-Lay to absolutely go kill Black and Blue, for sure. Also, Snoop Dogg is in the bar in that scene. In a tiny little cameo. Yeah, he's there. So, we're to the end game of the movie. T-Lay is disposed of as a threat because he rounds up Black and Blue one last time and takes him to like a construction site where there is a porta potty set up on a hill. Mystical, who is one of T-Lay's right hand men, whose character is actually named Stupid. Mystical is holding them at gunpoint while T-Lay goes and takes a shit in the porta potty.
Like there is a scene in this movie where. I don't know if this is the exact line, but it's very close, where Tiny Lister says, I'm going to kill you guys in a minute. Right now, I got to go take a shit.
Yeah. And he makes Stupid just hold them at gunpoint until he gets out. Black and Blue deal with Stupid. Blue asks for like one last request before dying. And he asks to get high.
Do you mean this is the part where the movie turns into a Looney Tunes cartoon?
Yes. He says, we just want to get high before we die. And weirdly enough, Master P refers to it as dust, which makes me think that they're going to smoke angel dust.
Yeah, like because he says we're about to meet the angels.
We better do some dust.
We better do some dust.
I don't know. But like it's clearly weed, even though it honestly looks like a tampon. It looks like he's pulling out and smoking a tampon.
It is a cartoonishly large blunt.
Yeah, so Mystical lights this thing up and starts smoking it, and it immediately knocks him out and makes him loopy. All the other gangsters just run away, and Black and Blue push the porta potty that Tiny Lister's in down a hill, and they run away. So they don't kill T-Lay. They just pull a prank on him, and that disposes of T-Lay.
Yeah, T-Lay is gone. T-Lay is out of the movie.
Yes. They return to the shopping center, where they are confronted by the two FBI guys. They pull off the two FBI guys' white guy masks, and everybody within the shopping center then runs them away. Like, chasing their police car or their FBI car down the street, running after it. And they run away in a cartoonish way. Then the cell phone fraud guy is done away with by a terrible transphobic joke. And then he takes a mask off, revealing himself to have not been a black man, which is what he's appeared to be this whole movie, but he's instead a white guy. And this is the point in the movie where you ask me, what is going on?
Yeah, I do not, like, I literally do not understand it.
And I don't understand
what is meant to be happening at this point.
I don't either. But he gets run away because he's revealed to be a white guy. Then one of the ladies with the broken TV from the beginning of the movie shows back up at the shopping center And because her TV is still broken, she threatens to shoot Blue in the butt with an old musket that she found. Then she shoots Blue in the butt. Then the movie ends with him saying, "She shot me in the ass!" And a little Looney Tunes like circle fade out.
Like a straight, that's all, folks.
Yep. In fact, there's one part where somebody says, "That's all, folks." And the captions get that line wrong also. Do we have any high points?
Let's see. The one thing I wrote down as a high point, I guess I wrote down two things. They use the theme from Shaft at one point, which is only a high point aesthetically.
They use the theme from Shaft, and there's a Curtis Mayfield's Pusher Man is in here.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of good songs on the soundtrack.
Which violates the rule of don't make your audience wish they were watching a better movie.
That's true. Shaft and Superfly are both much better movies than this.
Much better movies. I would say Shaft 2000 is better than this.
Oh, definitely.
By a long shot.
Definitely.
Nobody throws a badge like a ninja star in this movie. Also, we skipped over it because you only covered the plot relevant sequences in the film. There's a lot you left out.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's just fucking around. And there's a scene where the cousin gets arrested, and then his mom shows up to bail him out of jail and walks through this hallway in the jail as though she is performing an exorcism, which is actually pretty funny. Like, they are revealed to be, like, super religious.
Yes.
In a very funny sort of way, I think.
Yeah. There's a scene after that where the cousin is in the car with his mom and dad, and they're driving back home. And the mom is talking about all the various ways that he's going to be punished. And that part's not bad either. Like, she says, "You're going to be grounded to your room." And the cousin says, "For how long?" And she says, "You're not coming out." Which I thought was not bad. There's also one funny line that Blue delivers. Like, most of Blue... Look, AJ Johnson is... I don't even want to call him a low-rent, poor man's Chris Tucker. Like, that's clearly his role. But he is so bad at riffing. It's mind-blowing. But I'm getting into low points here. So, the high point is, there's one part, as Ice Cube is driving away, where Blue just literally says, "That Ice Cube looking motherfucker," which was a funny line.
Yeah.
Like, now, acknowledging that Ice Cube looks like Ice Cube.
You talk about him being bad at riffing. There is a part
We're still in high points.
No, I actually did enjoy at least the idea of this part.
Okay.
And he said, like, Black is on the phone with Lorraine.
Yep.
And he says, she's like, "Yeah, I'll be at the Japanese restaurant. I'll be wearing a red dress, high heels, and no panties." And she says panties like that, which is...
Yeah, it's gross.
Super. She hits that T so hard.
Yeah.
And then Blue overhears this, and then there's like a... It's gotta be like full 30, 45 seconds of him like riffing responses to that, like, "I'll be wearing a cowboy hat and no pants."
Well, first Black says what he's going to be wearing. And he's like, "I'm going to be wearing a black shirt and a black hat and no boxer drawers."
Boxing drawers. I wrote that down.
And then Blue starts riffing on what he's going to be wearing or not wearing after that.
And I do, like, and the thing I wrote down was they left the gag reel in the movie. But I do kind of enjoy that, because that is kind of an Adam McKay sort of thing that he would do later in later films. That I don't think it is, like, this movie could have benefited from more of that.
Yeah,
being silly.
It's not a bad idea. It's just not executed very well. Like, honestly, like, we were talking about how the movie ends in total Looney Tunes fashion. I kind of wish it had been more Looney Tunes. I kind of wish it had been goofier. Like, because the one thing where they acknowledge that's Ice Cube, it's like the one really funny line, right? So, like, yeah, more of that. I wish they had done more of that. I think we've gone through a lot of the low points of this movie, but but it's transphobic. It's racist.
Homophobic. It's racist.
Yeah. Very offensive to people with a mental handicap. And it's a ripoff of a lot of Wayans Brothers stuff. Like the fact that we were, like, now that we've talked about that, I've started processing all these characters who were like In Living Color characters. Like, it's got a Wanda. It's got the Homeboy Shopping Network. It's got like some white cops who turn out to be goobs. I can name so many Wayans Brothers characters that end up being characters in this movie.
Yeah.
It's sort of transparently, we watched a lot of In Living Color, and we're just going to like barely not do that. We're going to sidestep it just a little.
Yeah.
To make it slightly different.
Nothing makes sense. And not even in like a fun, silly way. Because there's definitely a part of this movie that wants to be an action movie, right?
There's a car chase that I'll give it this. Even though the car chase is very cliche, they run into
They hit the vegetable boxes, Matt.
Yeah, they hit the vegetable boxes. It's like a competently shot car chase. I'd say it's one of the most competently shot parts of the movie.
Yeah. I do like the line that Master P says when he goes to see Roscoe, which is, you know, somebody pulls a gun and he pulls out two guns and he's like, what, you thought they stopped making guns after you got yours? That was a good line. That was a genuinely good line.
Yeah.
But that's a good action movie line. And this movie is a silly comedy, except when it doesn't want to be. And it's very incompetent at being both a comedy and an action movie. So it's incompetent at two things instead of one.
Yeah. It's very frustrating. Like, but that's also what rap album skits are, right? Like, they try to be funny and badass at the same time. And that's so much of what this movie is.
It is a 93-minute rap album skit. And that is my nightmare. And you made it come true.
That sounds a lot like a final thought. Any other final thoughts about I Got the Hookup?
It's real, real bad. It's real, real bad.
Gun to your head. You have to watch either I Got the Hookup or Big Money Hustlers again. Which one do you choose? And you can't choose the gun. You have to choose one of the movies.
I would just grab that gun and put it right up against my forehead, Matt. Go out to find. No, this one, I would take this one. Because they have that same, I don't feel like there was ever a script quality to them. Like, a lot of it feels improv'd. You know, and clearly, Big Money Hustlers is just kind of going off on something, but you know they have the same homophobia, they have the same transphobia and all that, but at least like the people in I Got the Hookup are not benefiting from like institutionalized racism like the way NSYNC Clown Posse is.
Yes. Also, I would choose I Got the Hookup also because there are some people in I Got the Hookup who are actors. Master P's not an actor. AJ Johnson is only sort of an actor. But Tiny Lister is enjoyable. He doesn't get much to do, but he's enjoyable.
This is his worst role.
Yeah. John Witherspoon has a gross, terrible character, but he's an enjoyable presence. Gretchen Palmer, who plays a Lorraine, is giving it her all, right? Like, she's trying to do a good job. Big Money Hustlers has no actors in it. It only has, except for Harlan Williams, but he's not really acting in that movie. At least this movie has some actors. It has Ice Cube and has Snoop Dogg. Like, it has things to look forward to as you're having to endure the awfulness that you're having to endure. So I would take this.
Now, what if it was Big Money Rustlers and you had to choose between seeing WCW Superstar Scott Hall and WCW Superstar Master P.
I think I don't think I liked Big Money Rustlers as much as I liked Big Money Hustlers.
No, it was 100% mega garbage.
It was awful.
Well, there's good news too, Matt. There's some very good news, which is that if you can draw Mario, you can also draw Luigi, which is what I have been doing the entire time we've been talking about this movie. Just to keep focused, just to keep the brain active.
Yeah, you got to do something. And the other good news is we're finished.
Yeah, we don't have to watch this ever again.
We've talked about it, and we've watched it, and we're done with it. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Perhaps with another rapper/actor right back at you film, or we might take a one episode break and do a Valentine's special.
Oh, that's right. It's the season of romance, Matt.
That's right. So we are going to decide whether or not we're going to continue the series or take a break for 1 week, do a Valentine's special, then get back to the rapper movies. We will let you know, and you can let us know which you'd prefer. By going talking to us on Twitter, I'm at the Matt D. Wilson. Chris is at the ISB. Let us know your thoughts, or you could email us at moviefighterscast@gmail.com. But we'll be back either way in 2 weeks with a brand new episode. Our music is by Michael Kill. Our website was designed by Sean Baugus. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
And keep your left hand up. It's a new sign-off line I'm trying. Because we're fighting a movie. Because we're, like, boxing it. So keep you block with your left hand.
This has been a Kleitas Media production.